Listeners, there's honestly nothing I love more than a good writing retreat, especially one that comes with solid coaching and the chance to meet other writers who are working on similar projects. This fall, three Author Accelerator certified book coaches are offering what sounds like a dream retreat if what you're working on is telling your own story. It's called Mainly Memoir, and it's a retreat for women writers in historic Biddeford, Maine. Mainly Memoir will provide 3 days in the gorgeous Maine woods in September, with one-on-one coaching both before, during, and after the retreat. It is the perfect opportunity to give yourself the gift of time and focus so that you can make real progress on your memoir this year. Mainly Memoir will be held from September 21st through 24th, 2023. A scholarship is available for a memoirist from a community that has been traditionally underrepresented in publishing. Learn more at mainlymemoir.com, and as you've probably guessed, mainly is spelled M-A-I-N-E-L-Y. So that's Maine the State, mainlymemoir.com.
Is it recording?
Now it's recording.
Yay!
Go ahead.
This is the part where I stare blankly at the microphone, try to remember what I'm supposed to be doing.
All right, let's start over.
Awkward pause.
I'm going to rustle some papers.
Okay.
Now 1, 2, 3. Okay.
I'm KJ Dell'Antonia, and this is hashtag AmWriting, the weekly podcast about writing all the things, short things, long things, pitches, proposals. We're the podcast about sitting down and getting your work done. And this week we are old schooling it, so take it, Jess.
I'm Jess Leahy. I'm the author of The Gift of Failure and The Addiction Inoculation. And you can find my work at The New York Times and The Washington Post and The Atlantic.
And I am KJ Dell'Antonia, the author of the novels The Chicken Sisters, In Her Boots, and the forthcoming Playing the Witch Card, as well as a nonfiction book, How to Be a Happier Parent, and the former editor and lead writer of The Motherlode at The New York Times.
Meaning my former boss, technically. We have a fantastic guest this week. We actually have a guest that has been someone I've wanted to have on for ages, someone I have respected and read for ages, and I'm so thrilled to have her here today because she has a new book to talk to us about that has been a bit of a pivot for her, which we're super excited about. Our guest today is Peggy Orenstein. The two books that I'm constantly talking about of hers are Boys and Sex and Girls and Sex. They are in my bookshelf. I have given them to people all over the place. They are amazing resources. She is a New York Times contributor. She's been on NPR's All Things Considered. She has an incredibly popular TED Talk called What Young Women Believe About Their Own Sexual Pleasure that is really, really good. I highly recommend you go and watch that. And she's just been honored all over the place. And Peggy, it is such an honor to have you on the show today to talk about your new book that we're going to get into in just a second.
Yay, I'm so excited to be here.
It's literally like we talk about this all the time, that sometimes when you are an author and you're trying to write nonfiction and you have to own your expert voice. I have a couple of books that I keep on my desk that on days that I'm not feeling very expert or I'm having a bit of imposter syndrome, and I pick them up and I say, there's that expert voice that I'm looking for. And one of them is yours. So I'm so grateful. Yeah, there are just days when you're not feeling it, and I need other people to lend me their juju.
I mean, first of all, I have constant imposter syndrome, but also, you know, for me, I really, I have kind of repelled expertise in a way over the years. Like, I feel like it in a really conscious way as a writer, I don't want to come off as an expert, so I always want to come off like I'm sitting on a couch next to you chatting. You know, like
right.
I am going through, I don't know anything. I'm just a journalist, you know? So like with Girls and Sex and Boys and Sex or anything that I'm doing, this book, Unraveling, I'm going through it as an amateur and as trying to be like a proxy for the reader and along with the reader. So the expert voice is actually a consciously inexpert voice.
Well, I think that's a similarity that we have. I mean, I write a lot about sort of this has been my experience. And so therefore, as a journalist, I've gone off and done all of this research so I can learn some things. And now let me tell you about them, which is why your books are a part of my library on It's not just the expert voice. It's a confidence. It's a place of trust. It's a place of sort of straddling that conversational and instructional voice that I love so much. So yeah, I think having those resources is invaluable, mainly because it allows you to sort of get in the headspace of, no, I know what I'm talking about, and here's how I'd like to communicate it.
I feel very seen. Thank you.
It's a really, really tough... It's a tough line, because for a lot of people who are writing about things that they are also experiencing, you can come off as a, you know, I'm writing about parenting because I have kids or something like that. And so for it to be research oriented and for it to be credible, I think that that's a really delicate, but also a really fun line to walk. And you do it very, very well.
I appreciate that. Thanks.
Well, let's pivot and talk. So, okay. Lots of expertise, boys and sex, girls and sex, fantastic resources. Everyone should own them if they have a boy or a girl and they want to, you know, any, all that stuff. But so we're tootling along. Peggy's thinking about what her next project is going to be. And she's got some ideas for, like Jess does, for these research oriented projects you're going to do. And then COVID hits. So Peggy, will you give us a little bit of an introduction into this new book, Unraveling, and what it is and why it happened?
Yeah. So, the short answer is lockdown. There I was. You know? But in some ways, I don't really see it as being, I see it as making sense within my work, because I feel like I've always, my larger beat has always been about examining the unexamined in ordinary mm-hmm. life. In women and girls' lives. And so this book used the kind of vehicle of making a garment from scratch. So I learned how to, I was always a knitter, but learning how to shear sheep and process and spin yarn and dye it with natural dyes and make a sweater as a way to look at things like, why don't we look at our clothes the way we look at our food? A little bit of that omnivore's dilemma, to look at the history of women and girls' work and the way that handcraft has always been a vehicle for political dissent. And like, there's a reason why we knit hats when Donald Trump was elected president. It wasn't a random thing to do. Or looking at, there's the kind of goofy stuff like why the ancient Greeks didn't see blue, or creativity. And then also weaving in my own story, because I've also always kind of put an eye on my own life about what it means to be hitting this point where I'm, you know, at later midlife, facing the empty nest, living in Northern California in the fire zone. My mom has died. My dad, during lockdown, he had dementia and was in a facility in Minneapolis. So I couldn't see him possibly, I thought, forever again. And so sort of all those strings, if you will, and taking them and sort of knitting them together into a memoir that was about all of it. And a lot about mothers and daughters as well.
There's been this wonderful... genre that's emerged over the past couple of years of people examining something. Lulu Miller's Fish Don't Exist is another book I'm thinking of examining something in them and getting into the research around that topic and allowing it to take you lots of places that you didn't expect. And of course, this book is right down my alley because, oh my gosh, so much etymology, like wool gathering and what a spinster is and all that sort of stuff. I eat that stuff up. But that's the wonderful thing about this book is that, yes, it's about the creation of a particular sweater from the beginning to the end, but it's could only have been written by you. And by the way, this book or a book about creation could go in so different, many different ways, but this is an overlap between, I'm going to give you some really good knowledge, but this is also very, very personal and very memoir oriented. That intersection of memoir and nonfiction is my happy place. So that's one of the reasons I loved your book so much.
Thank you. Yeah. I mean, when I started, I had just, Boys and Sex had just launched. I had been touring the country doing all this stuff. And suddenly, all of us, suddenly everything stopped. And what do you do now? And so, that was sort of what launched me into this project. And what I knew, I'd always had this kind of bee in my bonnet because I'm a journalist. I'm always asking questions. I was like, who thought of string? You know, why did any, why, who thought of knitting two sticks, you know, and do it? Like, how did that happen? So I've always kind of wondered those things. And that was an occasion. So I knew that that was going to be sort of one piece of the braid of the book. I had no idea where that was going to take me. I mean, that's the part that's, you know, discovery. And I mean, it's scary. And for me, with my books, I always do that. There's always, like, with Girls and Sex and Boys and Sex, less because I'd already done Girls and Sex, but Girls and Sex, just, I mean, at one point I went out with a friend who was a teacher and she started telling me about hookups. I had never heard of that. That was like where I started. No, I was just like, huh, nobody's been writing about girls and sex. And it seems like when we're writing about all the things that have changed for girls, why is nobody writing about that? And I wonder what might be going on. I mean, that's as far as I go. And I'm going to talk to some girls and find out. And then I have to go and, you know, like figure it out. And I think the challenge in this kind of writing is to allow yourself to remain open. And I say this kind of blithely because I'm done with the book right now. If you caught me mid, I'd be kind of hysterical. But to stay open and say, I'm going to allow myself to not know and to just see what I discover and bring back, even though I don't know if it will be anything. I have to, like, trust that something will occur that I will want to be writing about. So with all my books, that's the challenge. With this one, yeah, I really didn't know where, you know, like, I knew it was going to be about my mom. I didn't know it was going to be so much about my dad and my relationship with my dad. I didn't know it was going to be so much about my the mother-daughter between my mom and me, the mother-daughter between my daughter and me. You know, I didn't know all these different things that we were going to go into it.
But what is so interesting about you and the overlap between all of these books is that editors and readers trust you to dig deep enough to find something interesting and then tell us. I mean, I could see a lot of people who might go, oh, I just found out about hookups. I'm going to talk about that and I'm going to interview some people. I'm going to figure some stuff out and then I'm going to write a book. And, you know, I can see a lot of editors going, okay. I mean, maybe not. I don't know. But you have a great deal of credibility in this space. Was it challenging to get them to see this as a good use of that? I mean, it is just women's and girls and spinster work, after all.
I know. And it's been more challenging. Well, I'll get to that in a second. But the yeah, I mean, I think I have earned. You were mentioning in your introduction about what the show is, pitching. I'm really good at pitching, I will say. I really am good at pitching. And that's years of magazine work. So I got very good at that. But yeah, I thought I always pitch more than one book. So, like, when I pitched Girls and Sex, I had also pitched a book about my family history, and which is a little weird because I'm Jewish, and my grandparents were homesteaders and lumberjacks in the Midwest. Which is not the typical story. And so I wanted to write about sort of like how that, they would kind of look at that and go, girls and sex, homesteading Jews in North Dakota. How about girls and sex? You know? But this time, I think what I benefited from was, like, right. And I honestly, like, I was almost reluctant. I thought they were going to laugh at me. And I was talking to my agent. I was like, well, I do have this one thing, like, in this little voice. But everybody was off making sourdough, right? Lockdown had happened. What did everybody do? They started making sourdough and, like, felting little things and, you know, making Harry Styles a sweater. So it was very zeitgeisty. They were like, yeah, that's what everybody's doing. And, you know, 10 minutes later, they might not have been doing that anymore. But I sort of got in on this moment. So I think that's why it's been very hard, I will say, to get out there. I feel like it's gotten wonderful reviews and people who read it really like it. But I think that I think I'm hitting, honestly, some ageism and sexism. And I don't know if you all have hit this yet. You will, if you haven't, where there's a kind of fear of being associated or people thinking that people like me might be your audience, even though, like, I'm looking at, like, NPR and thinking, who do you think is paying for the lights on there? You know, like, who do you think is listening? And the fact that, you know, I just wrote a piece for the Times on on women, the history of women using fiber arts as a vehicle for political dissent. It was number one on the site for days. But I can't get covered on this book.
It's really interesting that there's, especially I think because of the confluence of COVID, but I was actually thinking of you the other day because I was on TikTok and there's a really popular knitter on TikTok who is African-American and young, like in his early 30s, late 20s, something like that. And so it seems like...
Well, and male, apparently.
Yeah, and male, yeah.
Like, three very
And then there's a kid and the... Yeah, and then there's a kid who's a crochet whiz, and he's out there right now on TikTok crocheting his little 8-year-old or 9-year-old heart out. So anyway,
why are these all male? That's so...
Well, I know. Well, that's what I'm just talking about, a contrast to what she's sort of putting out there, is that it appears that there's some more room there.
Yeah, I will say that one thing I did want to do with the book, because I am who I am, you know, I'm a middle-aged white, you know, cisgender, straight person. Mm-hmm. I didn't want anybody else in the book to be that, because I simultaneously want to say, I'm not throwing people like me under the bus. You know, if we were the only ones who knit and we did all this, you know, amazing work with our handcraft, so what, you know, but it happens that that's not true. And people of all ages, races, and genders, and gender identities, do handcraft. And so the only time I kind of really mention it is with the shearing teacher, because I really did want to learn from a woman. And that was the challenge, because there's very few female shearers. But the people in the book that are my teachers, all of them have something that would position them as being different from those things that I am, different from my demographic, because I did want to make the point subtly or overtly that everybody does handcraft, and that it is essential to our mental well-being and our political activism for all of us.
And it's an integral part of our language, and it's an integral part of the way we think about, you know, even concepts that we don't realize are tied into that language. Like with you did such a great job. And again, that's my dorky sweet spot.
I know.
Spot,
I had never thought about it, but texting, when we text on our phone, that comes from the same word as textile. And what do we call those things when we have a bunch of texts? We call them threads. Mm-hmm. Like that's virtual. That's not even physical. And we're still, we come into this world wrapped in cloth, right? We're wrapped in cloth. We leave this world, we're wrapped in cloth. We spend our life wrapped in cloth. The making of cloth has been integral to human history and identity, and you know, it's literally forever. So of course it permeates our language, of course it permeates creation stories, except for the Judeo-Christian ones. You know, it's ubiquitous.
Yeah, and I loved your mention of, you know, the story of the Minotaur and Ariadne and the thread that she sends into the maze with, it's just all of that stuff is, as a former Latin teacher, always excites me. And for me, knitting is very much a part of my relationships, because KJ encouraged me to knit, and I learned how to knit. I got knitting really in the rooms of AA, which is at women's meetings. It's a very common thing to see a whole bunch of people knitting there. So for me, it's a very personal part of my recovery story as well.
But it makes sense to me, because it's, I mean, I know that a lot of people, not necessarily consciously, but they always say, well, you know, I don't eat as much when I, you know, but I bet the same thing, like it occupies your mind and your hands, and it's better than smoking.
It's also a legitimate and accepted way to still continue to do something while you're still listening. Like, you're clearly still listening, but you're doing something else at the same time. KJ knits at hockey games when she's there watching her kids play. You know, she's knitting all over the place. So it's a great thing to be doing with your hands when you're doing something else. But I'm sorry, we got to get back to this. Do you know how I first learned that we share a publicist is that I was accidentally emailed your publicity materials for Girls and Sex back when The Gift of Failure was coming out? It was also how I realized very, very quickly that publicists have a very limited window of attention for a given author, because that's how I knew that I was done and your stuff was started. Because all of a sudden I was receiving Peggy Orenstein's PR materials instead of my own. And I'm like, and there we go. We're moving on to a new phase where this is clearly just going to be me, which was also nice to know. It was a good thing to know. So anyway, you know, the thing about this, about the idea of doing something during COVID and allowing that to be the story, and not necessarily, we didn't know where COVID was going either, let alone know where your story was going to go. How is, as opposed to having a body of research with your proposal where you kind of sort of know where it's going to go, is it frightening for you to start a project and let alone have a contract for a project where you absolutely do not know where that project is going to go?
Yeah, yeah, it really is. But that's true. Again, it's been true with every book. And there's always a point. And I mean, I always think, I don't know how books get done. I don't know if you all have this experience, but I feel like there they are, right? And every time I think, I'm going to remember this so that next time, and I have written 8 books, that next time I will know I can do it and I will know how it's done. Never remember. It's, I guess it's like giving birth. You know, you just can't remember how it happened after it's over. And so I always feel this terror that, oh my gosh, I got a contract on basically a letter. I have no idea if this is possible. I've kind of learned to accept that as part of the process a little bit, or at least I say that after a book is over. I don't know if I was, you know, when I start a new one, if I can still say that, but there is always a point with every book where I think, okay, I start having this fantasy, I'm not going to do this book. I've got this other book. I'm going to tell them I can't do this book. I'm going to do this other book instead. And that book I know how to do. And that book is, and then I kind of, or, and I had a friend who said to me, don't you always say that you can't do it at a certain point? And I kind of looked and went, yeah, but this time I mean it. This time I really can't do it. This time I'm really going to go to law school. So yeah, it always is a little terrifying. And to some degree, well, I was going to say this one less so, but I'm remembering now that I was driving back from Sonoma where I was shearing my sheep, and I was talking to a friend who I grew up with, who's also a writer, who's really the reason I'm a writer, on the phone, and saying to him, I so screwed myself. There is just no way I'm going to get a book out of this. I don't know what I'm going to do. We were in high school, and he's 2 years older than I am. So he was like the columnist at the high school newspaper that wrote the cool column. And I thought, oh, I want to be him when I grow up, and I'm, you know, 17. And so I blame him, you know, whenever I get into this jam and I'm like, I can't, I call him up and go, this is all your fault.
All right. Well, I want to pivot to a question that I get a lot, and I'm dying to ask you this question. So we had a lot of questions about organizing research and how you know when you're done researching and ready to start writing, or when you need to kick yourself in the butt and move from the researching part. Because I don't know about you, but I love, love, love the research, and I tend to over-research. So 2 questions. Most of my research is done on paper. It's either articles, as you know, clearly you did with Boys and Sex and Girls and Sex, but there's also a lot of interviewing. For you, there's a lot of experiential research and a lot of places where you couldn't necessarily write stuff down while you were doing it, like, for example, shearing a sheep with your fancy shoes that you bought that soak up the lanolin on the bottom and stick to the floor. And by the way, I want those shoes. I don't care how ugly they are, but I want them. So how do you organize your research, especially when it comes to non-traditional sources, like your notes from interviews and your experiential stuff? And then how do you get to the place where you feel like, okay, I have enough here that I need to actually start getting the writing done?
It's funny, again, you know, like books write themselves and then you forget. So I sort of don't remember when exactly I started writing this book or where I started in the process. It in some ways, well, so I always have files for the chapters that sort of evolve, or they don't really start out as being for the chapters. They start out as being,
when you say files, what do you write in, first of all?
Computer.
Okay. Do you use Word, Scrivener?
Gosh, I used to use Word, but it got really unstable. Yeah. And I kept losing stuff. And with this book, I used Google Docs.
Okay.
Sometimes I have used Scrivener also, but I'm not as proficient at it, so I get frustrated. But I think
Scrivener. So when you say you use files in Scrivener land, I know what that means because I can have all these little files on the side. Yeah. When you say you have files, do you just mean electronic files of notes?
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. So like I would have something with color and everything I was reading about color. I got really one of the things I got in terms of the research. Well, there's a lot of research in this book, I guess. But I got very obsessed with color early on and the way color was a social construct and the ancient Greeks not seeing blue and the, you know, the idea of like, which completely blew me away. But then I was like, yeah, but other cultures see things as rough or smooth, shiny or dark, and they don't care that it's blue, you know. But I don't, like, I'm looking at a blue wall right now that's rough, got some kind of rough thing on it, fabric. I would not have said, oh, that's a rough wall. I would have said it's a blue wall because I don't care about rough as a primary descriptor. So things, anyway, reading about that stuff, I just like take notes, throw them in a file, take notes. And eventually I called that file blue. And then I would look at blue and go, oh my God, blue has gotten totally out of control. I need to separate blue into other files. And I kind of keep going back and looking and separating and reading and looking and separating, and kind of going all over the place, whatever's striking my fancy, I guess, or whatever I think I'll need. And then slowly, I mean, this book, I kind of had a sense of at least basic structure more than my previous books because it had an order of how I was making a sweater. So I was like, well, the first is going to be, there's going to be something about shearing, and then there's going to have to be something about spinning, and then there's going to be something about dyeing, and then there's going to be something about knitting. So I knew there was at least four parts to it. And then within those parts, eventually think, you know, I eventually spun off, as you were, as it were, fairy tale stuff into a different chapter or, you know, things. So there's some of that, but with the kids and sex books, it was more, and other books, I feel like I have to go interview until I'm hearing the same thing so many times.
Yeah, I'm nodding my head like crazy. That's when I know it's time to start writing, when I'm like, oh, I know this. Oh, I know that too. Okay, all right, I can go
now.
I've heard that.
Yeah. And so that's when I, and with those books, and probably with this one, although I don't know why I can't remember this, but I mean, it's not like it was a long time ago. It was months ago and I can't, it's gone. But with, I know that with boys and sex particularly, and I always say that I can't start writing a book at the beginning. If I start with an introduction, I'll try to put everything into that introduction, right? Everything.
Yeah.
And it won't work. And when I wrote my first book, when I wrote Schoolgirls, I think I tried to write the first chapter 15 times and I would lie on the ground and I would cry and I couldn't do it. And finally I thought, well, this is not working. I've got to try something else. And so I started to learn how to start where I could. And so like with Boys and Sex, the chapter I knew I could write early on was pornography. So I was still doing other research. I didn't know that masculinity was going to be at the beginning. I knew pornography was going to be in there somewhere. I knew I could write that chapter. So I wrote that chapter. And then I would report and write backwards and forwards from that. And the beginning of the book is the last thing I write. It's the very last thing, because that's when I know what it is I have to. Because, you know, there's that sort of adage, tell them what you're going to tell them, then tell them, then tell them what you've told them. Right. I don't know what I'm going to tell you until I finish the whole book.
That sounds really, really familiar to me. That sounds really familiar.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's pretty common. But yeah. I think it's because, I mean, I don't know. I never took a writing class except in high school. So I'm a self-taught writer. So nobody ever told me like tricks, tips, ideas of how you know, I just had to figure it out. And it's always interesting to me when I talk to other writers or when I talk, I don't get the opportunity very often to talk about writing because people are very interested in, you know, the kind of, especially with kids and sex books, like they want to know what to, you know, it's topic, it's content. And so to talk about process, which is also, you know, what Unraveling is about in the first place, it's about process and understanding the value and meaning of process in a creative act. So I'm really happy to be able to talk about process. And I love being able to talk about it with other writers and discovering that a lot of us basically find our way to the same kind of way of working.
Because the sweater was the point, but the sweater was not at all the point of your
book. Right. And people keep joking, you know, saying, it's not ugly. It's not because it's on the back of the book. And I'm like, yeah, it's, although it kind of, I feel like it's gotten better looking, like the sweater is taking off a life of its own. And every time I bring it to an event, it looks nicer. And I think, wow, this sweater, I mean, maybe because it's getting softer, so it's molding to my body more. But it looks a lot better than it used to. But I called it ugly anyway in the title, partly because I like the title, but also because it didn't matter. Like, that wasn't the point. The point was not that it was ugly. The point was that I did it. And that's with writing too. The point is that I always say the difference between me and people who want to write is that I do it. Not that I am more confident, not right. that I feel like I'm better, not that I think that I don't have doubt or that I don't feel like an imposter or that it's not hard or any of the things that people feel. It's just that for whatever reason, I've been able to do it. Any, you know, that I just go, okay, yeah, I feel like I can't do it. I suck and I'm an imposter and okay, get to work.
Well, there's a reason that Bill Bryson's Walk in the Woods or A.J. Jacobs books or whoever, someone who just decides to step off the cliff and do the thing, I'm all in. I want to be there with them. I want to learn what they learn. I want to see the mistakes that they make. And I may never do that thing, but I'm totally with you for the ride. So that's that. You're writing the stuff that I love most. And the reason I asked about the research is I was thinking when I was reading the chapter about shearing, where I know you can't have a pen in your hands. I know you don't have paper nearby because there's lanolin everywhere. There's blood. It's gross. So the very first thing I thought of was the chapter in Michael Pollan's book about how to change your mind. He was talking about trying to convey the details of tripping on LSD, for example, into words. And you do a beautiful job because I realize you're going to have to do all of that in retrospect and you're taking as many notes in your head as you can because it's not possible to write the thing down while you're actually doing it. And my temptation is always to have the paper right there. So that's one of the things, the reason we talk so much about nuts and bolts here is because those are the things I think other writers appreciate, is how you capture the immediacy of an experience when I know that you couldn't have been writing it down while it was going on.
Well, okay. So first, I want to say two things. One is the blood was my blood.
Right. Yeah. Sorry. Yes. Exactly.
The sheep are not harmed by shearing. Right. They need shorn, and it doesn't hurt them. But yeah.
And I was terrified on your behalf because whizzing blades and having to say stop rather than like throwing the clippers across the room when you're sure. The whole thing got me very nervous.
It was really hard.
The point.
Yeah, but I did manage to cut. The sheep was fine, but it looked like a crime scene because I was cutting my own fingers off all the time. And it's funny because I think about Michael Pollan's book, Omnivore's Dilemma, when I think of this book and how, one of my questions is, why don't we think about our clothing the way we think about our food?
Right, right.
Without sustainability. But that's an interesting thing. But yeah, so with that, I would, I'd shear and then I would have a break and I would run off and I would talk into my notes. I think I recorded it.
Yeah.
I would just talk.
Nice.
Because I couldn't take notes. So I would just turn on iTalk and just, you know, go, okay, I was and just like say everything that was in my head as much as possible. And then I would be driving home and I would be, you know, oh yeah, and this and blah, blah, blah. And so I just tried to do as much as possible. And then later I listened to it. And you can also talk right into notes.
Yeah, I found out the hard way that adrenaline can mess with your memory sometimes when you're really working hard on something. That's why you got to get those notes down when you're right in it, or sometimes I lose them.
The things that I say about notes, and this was something I learned when doing my first book, Schoolgirls, was first of all, your eye is a camera. And if you notice something, no matter how trivial that thing seems to you, write it down, because you may find out 3 months from now when you're writing the book that turned out to be important and linked to something that you didn't know it was going to link to.
Yeah.
So write it down, even if it's like I noticed the light switch. I mean, especially when you're new to it, that you just should write everything down because it might matter later. And the other thing is that I have to write the phone has made it easier because I can just talk into the phone. But when I used to handwrite, especially because I developed this very bad handwriting when I was writing about kids because they were always looking over my shoulder. So I started writing in a way that they couldn't read, but now I can't read it either. And notes are notes, you know, you can't be quite as complete. So I try to write them up. This is my advice. I don't always heed it. I try to write them up in 24 hours because it will be, and the sooner the better, because it will be gone. You will, at least me, I lose it. And so everything, there's an immediacy. And
anytime I hear myself say, oh, I'll remember this, that's when I need to write it down.
And I always wish that I always mean to, and I never do also like keep the pad by the bed because, you know, if I am, I have such good ideas. At least I think I do, because I don't remember them at 7 a.m.
Yeah.
But I'm sure they were good. And I thought I'd remember them, you know?
Yeah. All right. Let's take a quick break.
Writers, I know you love Serena Bowen, but have you
read Serena Bowen? If you haven't, you should. First off, because her books are killer fun, and secondly, because every one is a masterclass in pacing, characterization, and plot. And if you think plotting romance is easy because, quote, we know what's going to happen, unquote, then call me again after you've tried it. Her latest is The New Guy, but if you're new to her world, I strongly recommend Brooklyn Air. Bet you can't stop with just one. Find out more at serenabowen.com.
All right, and we're back, and let's talk about what we have been reading. We always love our guests to go first. So, Peggy, what have you been reading?
So, I am embarking on, well, one thing I just read was Cagey's new novel, which I loved and can't wait to have it be out in the world. I am also now on a kind of personal project where I am toggling back and forth between reading David Copperfield and reading Barbara Kingsolver's Demon Copperhead, which is
an updating.
But I read David Copperfield a million times in college, but haven't really read it since. And then I started reading Demon Copperfield and feeling like, oh gosh, I know she's referencing David Copperfield, and I can't. So I thought I'm going to read them together, and it's been, oh my god, it's been such a joy. I'm having such a good time with it.
That is so cool. I love that. Now that's what I'm going to have to do now that you mentioned that, because I do have the Barbara Kingsolver and it didn't even occur to me, but that's a fantastic idea. I'm going to have to do that. KJ, what have you been reading?
So I want to say thank you, Peggy. You're the first non-relative, non-related person to read Playing the Witch card.
I haven't read it. It's so much fun. And it makes me totally hungry.
all my books seem to do that. They just did a Reese Witherspoon Instagram stack of books that make you hungry, and I noticed that mine got like all the comments. I was like, well, yay, that's what I do best. I can make you hungry. There's a career for me in restaurant writing, yeah, or something, if the rest of it falls through. Anyway, I am reading, although I am not finished, but I am reading Lisa Belkin's Genealogy of a Murder. And I feel like it kind of goes in well with this conversation because, for among other things, we've all worked with Lisa, but also, you know, the amount of research and the depth of this are incredible. It's the story, it's basically the story of American immigration in one doctor, one cop, and one murderer. It's really cool.
I can't wait to read that one. I'm so excited. I went back. We all have those to-do piles that get really old and we haven't touched them and they get dusty. So I pulled out an old dusty to-read pile, and I am reading Alexandra Horowitz's Inside of a Dog, What Dogs See, Smell, and Know, and I am loving it. And I'm also reading Philip Zimbardo's book, The Lucifer Effect, Understanding how good people turn evil. For a couple of reasons, not just because of what I'm writing now, the novel I'm writing now, but because I've always been fascinated with why good people do bad things. And my husband is an ethicist, and so it is leading to a bunch of really interesting conversations at our house. But I am loving both of those books. I highly recommend the go back and find those dusty piles at the bottom of your to-read pile and then stick them up on the top.
You know, I don't know if you have this, but there's certain books that I feel so jealous because they're wonderful, but also I wish I thought of it and wish I'd written it. The dog book. That's my, her dog book is one of those books. I wish I'd written that book. Not just because it did so fun and because I love my dog.
Yeah. Yeah. No, because I love these sorts of books. I'm always thinking, oh, the new Beaver book that's out, I want to read that one. Or Pests, the other one that I've loved recently. I wish I'd written that, but you know, whatever. Next,
You get to read it. That's cool.
Yep. That will have to suffice at the moment. Peggy, thank you so, so much, not only for writing a book that I found just so much fun to read. By the way, I have been consuming it as audio. So it's a very different experience because I don't have a picture of the sweater. At the beginning when you talk about knitting the sweater at the beginning of each chapter, there's like a whole little thing about putting a sweater together. And I, because I don't make sweaters, I'm not that good. I only knit triangles. I don't know what some of that stuff means. So, and the good thing is that Peggy's book is one of those books that has attached PDFs so that you can actually see what she's talking about, even if you have the audio version. So that works out really, really well. Yep.
And you don't get to see my daughter's drawings that way. That's sad.
No. And, you know, there's some sacrifices with audio when it comes to books that have a visual component. Like A.J. Jacobs' book on puzzles. I couldn't see the puzzles that he was talking about unless you have that PDF that goes along with the book. So, but thank you so, so much, Peggy. This has been such a pleasure. And like I said, you have been, you know, you have influenced my writing in lots of ways. And I'm really, really grateful for that.
Thank you so much. That means the world to me. This was super fun. Thank you.
Excellent. Until next week, everyone, keep your butt in the chair and your head in the game. The Hashtag Am Writing podcast is produced by Andrew Perella. Our intro music, aptly titled Unemployed Monday, was written and played by Max Cohen. Andrew and Max were paid for their time and their creative output because everyone deserves to be paid for their work.
Listeners, I've got a podcast recommendation for you. Have you tried A Bookish Home yet? I've been a guest, and it's a delight. Librarian and writer Laura Zaro Kopinski interviews a different author each week, so you can add to your TBR list while getting the inside scoop on the winding road to publication. Coming up this spring, she'll be talking to Amy Poppel, Sarah Penner, Maggie Smith, and many more. So, look for A Bookish Home wherever you get your podcasts.